Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. You know, when you go and you choose a candidate for political office, most of us look at a variety of positions that the candidates stand for, and we try to figure out which issues approximate our own. It's very rare and unusual to get a candidate that agrees with us on all positions, but we look at a variety. We say this candidate mostly supports what we support, and we pull the lever. There are some issues, though, that for some people make all the difference in the world. There are some issues like gun control or gay rights or the environment or Social Security where someone will look at a candidate stand on that issue alone, and that will decide it. That will decide it for that voter more than any other issue. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the single issue that's the greatest single issue for single issue voters is the issue of abortion. And I'm talking about both sides, whether you are pro-life or pro-choice. There are people who have told me that, you know, Mark, I agree with the Democrats on taxes and on Social Security and in the environment, gay rights, but I'm pro-life. I cannot vote for a candidate that believes that abortion should be legal, so I'm going to hold my nose and pull the lever and vote for that conservative. And flip side, I have had people who tell me, you know, I like the Republicans' views on foreign policy, on tax policy, but I'm pro-choice, and I just can't hold my nose and vote for a candidate who believes that all abortions should be banned, so I'm gonna vote for the person who's pro-choice. And what's interesting to me, and what I'm trying to understand, and hopefully in this hour I will understand, is the incredible passions in this issue and whether there's any hope for compromise. Frankly, it doesn't seem to me like there is. If you're pro-life, if you believe that from the moment of conception, that is a life, a child, a baby, equivalent to human dignity to you and me, well, ending that life is murder. There doesn't really seem to be an exception. And if you are pro-choice and you believe that a woman's body is her own, it belongs to her, it's her body, and the government can't force her to be pregnant if she doesn't want to be, well, I guess I don't see any compromise there either. But I'm going to talk with two people who are really experts on both sides of this, people who've really thought about it. And, well, I'm going to get right to them. My first guest is going to be Randy Alcorn. He's the founder and director of Eternal Perspective Ministries. He's the author of two books. One is called Why Pro-Life, and the other is called Pro-Life Answers to Pro-Choice Arguments. And then later on, I'm going to have Ann O'Hanlon. She's the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Virginia. And, of course, we will take your calls. All you have to do is dial in 877-57-SCOOP. Now, I know abortion is a passionate issue on both sides. And so I've decided, in a way to get out some real discussion and not, well, a lot of talking over each other, is to divide up the show into 15-minute segments. I'm going to do my first 15 minutes with Randy Alcorn, who is definitely pro-life. Then I'm going to spend my second 15 minutes on Ann O'Hanlon, back again to Randy Alcorn, back again to Ann O'Hanlon, so they can address each other's arguments, but both have a good enough time to speak. So without further ado, let me first introduce you to Randy Alcorn, the founder and director of Eternal Perspective Ministries. Randy, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be with you.
Let me ask you this. It would seem to me that to be pro-life, you believe that from the moment of conception, that is a life, a human life of equivalent human dignity to everyone else. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that is a fair statement, absolutely.
Okay, is there anything else that you would characterize as the pro-life position, just the basic pro-life position?
I think that regardless of size and age, wherever you are on the continuum between conception and death, it doesn't matter how big you are. It doesn't matter how old you are. NFL players and NBA players are not better than jockeys because they're bigger than jockeys, and a 10-year-old is not better than a 3-year-old, who is not better than a 1-year-old, who is not better than a preborn child, and a teenager is not better than any of those. It's just simply to be on the continuum of human life, not where you're on it and what condition you are on it.
So that would mean, obviously, that you reject the characterization in the 1973 case of Roe v. Wade, which said that basically just before birth, when a fetus is strong enough to live outside the mother, that's a life of equivalent human value, I guess, to you and me. But when it's a zygote, when it's smaller than a period and can't live outside the mother, that is something that can be aborted. I assume you completely reject that character.
That's right. I do reject that, and I think it should remind us of the fact that it's not how dependent you are. For instance, a born child you leave a one-year-old alone and neglect that one-year-old, and that one-year-old will die. That one-year-old is as dependent upon adults as a preborn child is. And so we would never use that logic to say, well, then the one-year-old really isn't a human being. We recognize it is a human being, even though it's dependent upon adults.
Of course, there is one distinction, and I pardon me if I ask you some tough questions. I plan to ask Anne O'Hanlon tough questions,
sure,
too, I promise you. But obviously, a one-year-old that you leave alone can be taken care of by any adult, whereas a one-month-old embryo can only be taken care of by his or her mother.
That's right. That's absolutely true. And then the question we have to ask ourselves is, is that divided fairly among all human beings? In other words, the woman who is carrying this child, was she carried by a woman who those same things were also true of? And did that woman have a responsibility, and did the man who fathered that child have a responsibility to care for this helpless preborn person? So I think it distributes responsibility equally. It's not asking of any woman something that would not have been expected of her own mother. And most people would say, hey, you know, I'm glad my mom didn't take my life, and I'm glad that she cared for me and loved me and took me through the full term of pregnancy. And she had a responsibility to do that, and I do too.
But of course, sometimes a child is wanted. Sometimes a baby is wanted. In that case, if a woman chooses to be pregnant, then obviously it's hard for her to complain later that she's pregnant. But if a woman doesn't make that choice, if birth control fails, or in extreme circumstances, in cases of rape, how can you ask a woman to carry for 9 months, to have her body undergo all those changes, a baby that she really never asked for?
Well, I think the question is whether the nature of the unborn child changes depending upon whether an adult or several adults want the child or not. The truth is that in one sense, there's no such thing as an unwanted child, in that you have 1.3 million couples waiting for adoption each year and only 50,000 new babies made available for adoption. So somebody wants that child, but of course, the woman carrying the child may not want the child. But the question becomes, does whether or not an adult wants a child affect the nature of the child? For instance, there are many unwanted women in America. There are many men who don't care about their wives and who abandon their wives and don't take care of their wives and don't fulfill their marriage vows to their wives. And there was a time in culture where people thought that a woman's value was largely dependent upon how a man viewed her and whether or not a man wanted her. And I think that's absolutely wrong, and I also think it's wrong to think that a child's value is determined by whether or not any adult wants them.
But, of course, most of us come into existence because our parents choose to have us. I mean, after all, there are lots of sperm and egg that never meet, and there are plenty of possible lives out there that never come to pass. How is it different preconception? I mean, if my mother and my father had decided not to have me, I wouldn't exist, and, I could complain about that, but obviously I wouldn't be around to complain. How does the moment of conception differ from, say, a few moments before conception?
Well, I think the moment of conception is where the new DNA is established. You've got the chromosomes from mother and father. This is the first time this individual has ever existed. This person is clearly scientifically not a part of his mother's body. He is located within his mother's body, but he has a completely different DNA. He has an independence. All of his character traits, including his height and his eye color and all, is determined at that moment. So you have all of the equivalent of hundreds of volumes of encyclopedia information that's built in to this person. And if allowed to progress, this person has a lifetime of choices in front of him. So when we talk about, are we pro-choice and are we pro-life? Well, I'm very pro-choice about the vast majority of choices that any person, including any woman, will make. One choice I am against, along with things like kidnapping and rape and other things like that, is the choice to take the life of a child, because that child will then be robbed of a life and of a lifetime of choices. The tens and thousands or hundreds of thousands of choices that he or she would have made in their lifetime are all taken away by one single choice of another person.
Randy, I have a lot more questions for you, but I want to go to the phones, which have lit up. If you want to call in, actually, all the lines are busy now, but I hope you will try in just a few minutes at 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Randy Alcorn.
This is Bill from Falls Church, and I just want to ask Randy one thing. If a human life is so precious, why won't he let stem cells be used to keep people alive?
I am all for stem cell research, and I'm all for using stem cells. I am not in favor of embryonic stem cells, and this is one of the things that is interesting in this debate. There are adult stem cells. There are stem cells from umbilical cord, from placentas. There's even stem cells taken from one's own person that recent research has shown can be very, very effective. I'm all for stem cell research, but I'm not in favor of killing unborn children to use their stem cells, because they're not just stem cells, they're people.
Can I respond?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. If the embryonic stem cells are not wanted by the parties involved, and both the mother and the father, why shouldn't those stem cells be used maybe to help another child of the mother or the father who has a serious debilitating illness?
Right. I think it's a similar question for those of us that believe that human life begins at conception. It would be similar to asking, why didn't the American Medical Association and other medical associations in the world feel the freedom to use the research and the human tissue and all that was collected by the Nazi doctors in Germany? Well, it was because there was a moral problem with what they were doing. They were using human beings in order to be raw material, to experiment on, to use supposedly for the benefit of other people. And after the war, there was a big debate about that. Why shouldn't we use this? After all, it was done. We're not even saying it was right that it was done. But there was a sense of, if we use this material and this research even, then what we will do is we will justify the taking of innocent human life, and we don't want to do that.
Aren't you making a judgment for people that you have no right to make a judgment about when you suggest that a zygote is a human life, when both the male and the female that produce the zygote feel like that the zygote, which contains embryonic stem cells which might be able to help another child of theirs, is needed more in that place? Right have you got to interfere with somebody else's life?
There are a matter of feelings, and then there are a matter of facts and scientific facts and when human life begins. And even most pro-abortion people are now beginning to acknowledge that what they said all along about product of conception and blob of tissue and all of that is really not true, that this is a distinct human life, even though that they don't recognize that it has, you know, the same rights. But I think it comes down to, do you believe that kidnapping is wrong? Let me just ask you, do you believe it?
I believe that kidnapping is wrong, but I also believe that I have no right to
interfere
tell
with
you
someone
whether
to,
you
whether, with
let me please let me finish.
Well,
I
no,
have no
actually,
right.
To... I was talking, and I'm just asking you to let me finish. I only ask you that question about the kidnapping because the point is, what right do you have to impose your anti-kidnapping morality on people who believe it's right to kidnap? In other words, it's either right or it's wrong. Let's keep our focus on the discussion of, are these adults who would like to use an aborted baby for stem cell research, are they correct in their judgment or are they not? To say that everybody can make up their own mind is like saying the man next door can beat his child to death if that's what he wants to do, and the rest of us have no right or responsibility to interfere. And I think we do have.
Well, all you're suggesting is that all of our laws are immoral and indecent. I suggest that a society as a whole must go ahead and make laws for the benefit of society, and that includes people who are alive and living, not little dots or zygotes.
Bill, thank you very much for your call.
That begs the question of what are alive and living, well, and in fact, scientifically, they are.
Well, Randy, I think that is the point. I mean, the question is whether or not it's a full life. Let me ask you this. If the decision comes, you have a pregnant woman, and this, you know, this very well could happen. It has happened throughout human history. There was a time 100 years ago when maybe one in five women died in childbirth. If it comes to a decision where you have to sacrifice the pregnant woman or the fetus? Is it your view that they're equally valuable, and if the woman has to die so the fetus can live, the woman should die so the fetus can live?
No, I believe that they're equally valuable, and I would trust and respect the decision of the people who are involved in that circumstance. It is an extremely rare situation where a choice has to be made between the two. But when that choice has to be made, more often than not, the choice, for instance, a fast-growing uterine cancer, the choice has to be made to perform a surgery which has as a side effect the death of that preborn child in order to save the life of the mother. More often than not, the mother's life is the life that can be saved. You certainly should not say, because we can't save one life without taking the other life, therefore we will not save either and both will die.
No, I understand that. But what if it comes to the case where really it's a matter of choice? I mean, the doctor could save the woman at the expense of the fetus or could save the fetus at the expense of the woman. Should you flip a coin? Are these lives truly equally valuable?
I think they are equally valuable in that they are human beings. They are not equally valuable on the subjective level, of course, because people have bonded with that woman,
sure.
And this woman has maybe other children and has a husband and has, you know, parents out there. So subjectively speaking, of course, more people will value her. Understandably, more people will value her. And as I said, I think I made clear tonight that I'm not saying that the woman's life should be taken in order for the child to be lived.
Well, I guess I take that same analogy then to the question of frozen embryos used for stem cell research. If you have to destroy an embryo that no one knows, no one loves, as you point out, hasn't bonded with anyone, has never existed in any real sense that we know human existence, in order to save a 14-year-old child with Parkinson's disease who people have bonded with, have loved, does think and feel and has brain waves, shouldn't that sacrifice be made for the same reason you might sacrifice a fetus to save a mother's life?
Well, I think what we have to ask ourselves is, does the fact that bonding has taken place with a person give more value to that person? For instance, you know, there's an earthquake in India, and most Americans maybe hear about it. They feel bad about it, and maybe they send some financial help or whatever, but their life moves on. Whereas if their father or mother or brother or sister or child dies, then, of course, because they have bonded with that person, their life is affected in much more dramatic ways. But would we then conclude that the value of the life of the person in India is less than the value of this person that we know just because we have bonded with them? So my point is there's a slippery slope here, and once we start defining human value on the basis of whether or not somebody loves or has bonded with or wants this person, then it carries over to all the rest of life, too. What about when we're not wanted? What about when we're not valued?
Let me ask you one more question, then I've got to go to commercial and get to Anne O'Hanlon. I know she wants to respond to some of this. But what about the question of brain waves? I mean, a frozen embryo has never had a thought. It's never had brain waves. You can argue that there's a heartbeat or brain waves at 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months.
Right.
But clearly a frozen embryo has never had a conscious thought, and a 14-year-old with Parkinson's disease obviously is thinking and feeling. And I know scientists often declare brain dead is a time when we declare someone is dead, Terry Schiavo case notwithstanding, as a tough case. Shouldn't we save the person who has a functioning brain over the person that has no brain waves?
Well, I think the 14-year-old with Parkinson's can be treated in numbers of other ways. I'm an insulin-dependent diabetic, and, you know, I've had people say to me, well, don't you realize that all the embryonic stuff, you know, I mean, that could be ultimately what takes away your diabetes, you know? And I say, well, you know what? I don't like to live with my diabetes, but I'm not going to sacrifice another human being, even another human being that isn't very old, isn't very advanced. The question that we have to ask, Mark, I think related to your question, is it a person's functionality or is it a person's nature that is what their value is about? I think it's a person's nature, and once we start going on the basis of how well can this individual contribute to the needs of other individuals, and how much can they consciously verbalize, participate in society? All of us were once young and weak. The strong should not take advantage of the weak and use them for their purposes.
And we're going to hear the other side of the issue. I promise I will ask her tough questions, too. Coming up is Ann O'Hanlon. She's the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Virginia. Ann O'Hanlon, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you.
Well, you heard what Randy had to say. Let me just start you off there and see if you have a response to him, and then I've got some tough questions for you.
Well, you guys went over an awful lot of material, obviously. I mean, I guess, you know, I think we all know at this point in this debate that I don't think Randy's going to change the minds of very many people. I don't think I'm going to change the minds of very many people, at least in the course of this hour. People pretty much know where they stand on whether or not they believe abortion should remain legal in the country. I think what it's important to talk about is sort of next steps, and what's happening now is, in terms of next steps, is that the some leaders in Congress are trying to work on prevention first, on birth control efforts, so that there are fewer abortions in the country. We reduce the number of unintended pregnancies. And what's distressing to a lot of us in the pro-choice movement is that we have obstruction on the side of the abortion opponents toward working to make abortions less common and less necessary. They're not working together with us on birth control measures, and that is what's really distressing to us.
One of the listeners points out on the blog, and this is definitely a pro-life listener, points out that there's a statistic by the Alan Guttmacher Institute that shows that for 46% of women, abortion is their only form of birth control. I don't know if you agree with that statistic or not, but it does sound awfully high.
I think they're making that up. I've looked at the Alan Guttmacher website quite a bit, and 46% of women do not use abortion as birth control. I think there are a lot of distortions you hear from, Randy's side of the movement. It is true that one in three American women will have an abortion before the end of her childbearing years. Using it as birth control is not something women do. It's expensive. It's emotionally and physically difficult to go through. They're simply sort of fictionalizing things to make those of us who believe abortion should be legal sound like unreasonable people.
Well, let me ask you this. With Randy, I focused on the very early parts, the embryo, the zygote, because for me, that is where abortion to me is the least troubling. With you, I'm going to focus on late-term abortions, on what they call partial birth abortions, where many of us have seen this very gruesome technique where they take a fetus that's could be 7-8 months old and grab it by the feet and use the scissors to stab it in the skull. It's an awful procedure, and yet people on your side want to defend it. Am I wrong there?
Yeah, you are wrong on a couple points of it, Mark. One is the timing, and again, people like to refer inaccurately to late-term abortions. The law of the land, Roe v. Wade, which the pro-choice side does not take issue with at all, we're completely in agreement, is that once there is viability, once that baby can live outside of his mother's body, the state, the government, has a right to have an interest. We don't argue with that. We don't take issue with it. We never have. That is about 24 weeks. The late-term abortions that people refer to are second trimester. They're rare. 91% of abortions take place in the first trimester, and they are often because of some kind of extraordinary circumstance. The parents receive word after amniocentesis happens in the second trimester that this is a profoundly deformed fetus. They go in for a procedure that is not what, again, that side likes to refer to as partial birth, which is a term they made up. Intact dilation and extraction is the medical terminology. Those procedures are used very rarely and used only in extreme situations. So I think, you know, certainly later term, second trimester abortions can be upsetting to a lot of people, but the motto that many of us live by is we trust women. We trust women to know what the reality is of the health of that fetus based on the medical information given to her, what the reality is in her family, and then to trust her doctor to use the medical technique necessary in the circumstance that is safest for her. And what they refer to as partial birth abortion is used very rarely and only in circumstances when the physician believes is the procedure that needs to be used.
Let me go.
I was just going to say, Mark, this is the first time we have seen the banning of a medical procedure in the history of the United States. Never before has the government felt that it was their duty to step in between a woman and her doctor. And suddenly, they do think that that's where the government belongs.
Well, let me go to the phones if I can. They are full, and that way it'll open up some lines for some other people to call in. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Anne O'Hanlon. Caller, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the line.
This is John Morrell from Oregon.
Hi, John. How are you?
Fine. I had a couple things to say about abortion.
Go ahead.
I think in the main, abortion should be left to women. That as you have this Randy and as you have Sean Hannity and Dr. Dobson spouting off about it, and I don't know whether I'm the only one that doesn't like to hear these men giving advice to women. It should be women that makes these decisions. And I think abortion should be very rare, and but I believe that a woman will know when they have to do that. I think we should have confidence that women will make a good decision.
Okay. Thank you for your comment.
I have had a personal experience with abortion. My wife had an abortion some 40 years ago when it was difficult to get in. There were no abortion clinics, and we had just had our fourth child, and a month or two later she became pregnant and said, I just can't do it. I cannot go through this.
Now, this was before abortions were legal, so what did you do?
That's right. We had to go outside the country.
To Canada or something like that?
Mexico.
Mexico. I would suspect the procedures in Mexico.
It was a very unpleasant experience.
I was going to say, I would suspect the procedures in Mexico were not quite as safe
in
the United States.
No, she just said she couldn't do it. And emotionally, she just absolutely could not go through that again. And she's just been through a pregnancy.
Well, John, let me ask you this. Has she suffered any kind of emotional reaction to her abortion?
I was about to say that, because the upshot of that is that in succeeding years, she has regretted that tremendously. It's been emotionally very hard on her. She regretted that, and I have myself.
Interesting.
I wonder if I can ask a question of the caller,
ahead.
Mark.
Go ahead.
Many women who have abortions don't regret the decision, but some do. I wonder if you and your wife believe that they should be illegal for all women because some women regret them.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think it should be left up to the woman, and women should have every right to make that decision themselves, and abortion in every way should be legal. I even think that the government should be paying for abortions, Medicare or Medicaid, because wealthy people can always do that, you know, but it's the poor people that have a problem. And I think it should be left to a woman.
Thank you, John, for your call. I appreciate it. And let me ask you about John's second point, because one of the controversies in abortion is precisely that. It's paying for poor women to have abortions. A number of people have written on my blog that the thing that really rankles them, and they are pro-life supporters, is when their taxpayer money is used to go to places like Planned Parenthood to provide abortions. How do you respond to those people?
The taxpayer money to Planned Parenthood, to my understanding, goes overwhelmingly to contraception, which makes abortion less common, less necessary.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, Mark, a lot of this is the same kind of arguments over and over again, but you know, we all have, it's part of living in a democracy, we all have things that our taxpayer dollars are used for that we don't agree with. Again, what people usually throw out most commonly is defense. A lot of people don't agree with the way some defense dollars are spent, or maybe they don't agree with the way some foreign policy dollars are spent. You know, you can be part of the government then if you want to try to change that, but what you can't do is stipulate, and if you could stipulate what your tax dollars go to, the democracy would break down. We, you know, have laws that are in place stipulating what things go to, and, you know, we just can't pick and choose. Not a cafeteria democracy that way.
Well, you make some good points. I'm now back to Randy Alcorn. He's the author of two books, Why Pro-Life and Pro-Life Answers to Pro-Choice Arguments. Randy, welcome back to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks.
Is there anything you want to respond to before I continue in what Ms. O'Hanlon had to say?
Well, I appreciate Anne. She sounds like an intelligent person and a nice person. I have to say I do think she's misrepresenting some things on the pro-life side of things and just some basic issues. For instance, in her response to the partial birth abortion question, it sounded like she was starting to say that she really agreed that, no, this was not appropriate. And then she ended up by saying, how dare a government interfere with this medical procedure between a doctor and a woman. And I would have to say that I don't think historically you can put on the shoulder of doctors. I know a lot of fine, very moral, very ethical, principled doctors, but there have also been many. You look at World War II and look at the Nazi doctors, and I mean, doctors are perfectly capable of making very immoral decisions. So I think it is appropriate for a society to look out for the lives of all of its members. And I think in a lot of ways a society is defined by how it cares for its weakest members. The other comment I would make is that the caller who said men should have nothing to say about this, it's always interesting to me when I hear someone say men should have nothing to say about this because, one, it's a human issue. We as men and women are in this together. Every child has a mother. Every child has a father. And if we expect men, and we should expect men and call upon them to fulfill their responsibilities as fathers, one way to do that is not to tell them that they really have no connection whatsoever to this preborn child. It's also interesting that the man who said that men should have nothing to say about this was a man saying quite a bit about it. It's just that he was saying it on the other side of the issue. And the final question I would say is why, on the question of his wife and the regret she experienced and the regret that he experienced, and then Anne asked the question, do you think that the procedure should be made illegal just because some people regret it while other people, don't regret it? I would ask what I think is a more basic question is, and that is, why are they regretting it in the first place? We took into our home years ago a pregnant girl when she was 17. I'd never been involved in any pro-life things, never even thought about the abortion issue, but she had two abortions. We saw the devastation in her life, and that's what encouraged us to get involved as pro-life advocates, was originally not concern for the unborn babies, but concern for the damage that we saw it doing to women, and in particular to her.
I want to go to the phones. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Randy Alcorn.
Well, it's your California fan club here, Mark. And Randy, two quick questions, I guess. I think this has too often been used as a political football, and I'd appreciate your thoughts on that, because most of the Democrats are very reluctant to get involved in abortion. Most of the Democrats feel it should be legal and safe, but rarely used. And the red states, it's quite prevalent. But yet it's been put out there as some sort of a Democrats killing babies. A second point I wanted to ask of you, at what point, if the compromise was possible, do you feel that in the womb there exists a real live entity, a human, as opposed to protoplasm forming and things like that? Because I think most doctors, their policy is if you go in the early, they have no problem with it. If you come in 6 months later, they say, why do you come to me now? And so,
Dave, those are two good questions. I'm going to hang up on you just because our lines are full to leave it open, but I will definitely address both of them to Randy. Randy, first the question of politics. Do you think abortion is too often used as a political football between the parties?
Well, yes, I think it is, and to say that everybody in a certain party thinks a certain way or believes a certain way. My recent book, Why Pro-Life, is endorsed by the head of Democrats Pro-Life. I mean, there are Democrats who are pro-life. There's no question about it. There are many Democrats who are pro-life. There are Republicans who are pro-abortion, or as they would prefer to be called, pro-choice. And so it's just a matter of statistical majorities. Yes, more pro-life in the Republican Party. But there are many things where I vote Republican, and there are many times where I don't vote Republican. And it's just a matter of looking at the individual issues. But I do think that this issue of the value of human life extends throughout the life of human beings, and I think for that very reason, it's not just the preborn child, but it's the handicapped, the disabled, the elderly, the sick, who ultimately are going to be disregarded as a result of that slippery slope that started with abortion.
Well, Randy, let me ask you about the second question Dave raised, because I actually had a listener who posted on this site on the blog before you came on a very interesting study And again, I don't know if these things are accurate. I'm not a doctor. But the study said that 50% of the time after conception, the fertilized embryo does not implant in the woman's uterus and is actually excreted, and that even when it does implant, some 15% of the time there's a miscarriage. And I guess my question to you is, if a fertilized embryo is a life of equivalent human dignity to you or me or anyone listening to this program, as you put it, it doesn't matter whether it's a jockey or a basketball player, it's all the same life, shouldn't we be taking extraordinary actions to prevent a fertilized embryo from just being excreted? I mean, shouldn't women wear some kind of protection so that, I mean, if this really were a life, if I really felt that this was a life equivalent to a member of my family, you know, I would think that half the time when it's naturally gone would be seen as criminal.
Well, I don't know that it's criminal. It's a fact of nature and biology, you know, but something is not being done to make that happen. There's a difference when a choice is made. You know, many people die of certain illnesses. We would see a difference between people dying of an illness and our injecting somebody with someone that brought on that illness.
True, but we work to stop the illness. I mean, yes, should be more be done to prevent.
You're right, and I think certainly education and care and many physicians do this. You know, there are all of these pregnancy care classes. Our daughters just gave birth, both of them in the last 7 months, you know, there are classes that are available. People go through them, how to, even before your child is born, here's what you're supposed to drink and not drink. In the state of Oregon, every restaurant you go into that serves alcohol has this thing up there that says, you know, drinking alcohol and pregnancy don't mix. And what's interesting is they show a pregnant woman, and inside they show a clearly visible little child with the features of a child. And I'm thinking, you know, it's interesting. In the state of Oregon, you're being advised not to do anything that harms your preborn child, but it's considered perfectly acceptable to kill that preborn child right up until when they're born.
Let me go back to the phones. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Randy Alcorn. Caller, you there? Last chance, caller. Caller, you there? All right, we're moving on to the next caller. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Randy Alcorn.
Yeah, this is Bert from Kansas.
Hi, Bert.
I'd like to ask a question to your pro-life guest. Let me basically say that it seems to me like pro-life people, anti-choice people, aren't giving God credit. Like the example of the miscarriage where the baby will never live to see the light of day, God's not going to put a spirit in that. He knows what's going to happen. He's omniscient. There's other cases of, like, identical twins. Does the spirit come in at conception? Does it split into two spirits? I mean, how many angels dance on the head of a pin anyway? We believe in a God that's smart enough to not put a spirit in something that's going to get miscarried. Why is it that we can't believe in a God that's not going to put a spirit in something that's just going to get used in lab tests or get aborted?
Randy, does God put a spirit into a fertilized embryo that is miscarried?
Yes, I believe so, and I think if you took that same logic, you see how faulty it is if you apply it to a three-year-old who dies. Well, that three-year-old died, and there's a sovereign God of providence. He knew the three-year-old wasn't going to die. I mean, was going to die, and so he didn't put a spirit in them. I mean, you can't say that just because a life is taken, somebody is killed. We wouldn't say that everyone who's been murdered, since God knew they were going to be murdered, he didn't put a spirit in them, and I don't think you can apply that logic either. But one comment I'd like to make is that on the anti-choice character, which I think is always an interesting one, to call the pro-life position anti-choice is I think very unfair, because we are pro-choice about 99.99% of the choices that a woman makes, and this is one of the very few we would be, quote, anti-choice about, but we are also pro-choice about all of the decisions that this child is going to make. And no one ever seems to talk about the fact that a lifetime of choices is being taken away from this child, as well as their own life, through abortion.
Randy, let me ask you this, and I sometimes do this occasionally. If the show were to go over on the Internet, the radio show were to end but were to go over on the Internet, would you be able to stay on a little bit longer?
You bet.
Okay, all right. Bert, go ahead and see if there's a response that you have to what Randy said.
Well, I mean, it's his argument. He's giving God the benefit of the doubt in the case of identical twins. because does the spirit come in at conception or does it split into two? He never answered that question.
All right, let me ask you
that. But
he's
not giving the benefit of the doubt in the case of things that go on to get aborted or used in laboratory experiments.
Well, let me ask him that. Randy, I mean, you've got one fertilized egg and then it divides into two. Is that one soul, two souls?
Well, I think at the point of the split where you have the distinction made, then that's two individuals with spirits. But until that point, it's not two, and so there would presumably be one, or however God orchestrates that. I mean, I certainly don't know.
You're giving him the benefit
the Bible,
of the doubt.
I certainly don't know, and the Bible doesn't spell out exactly how it happens with twins. But as far as the whole benefit of the doubt thing goes, if you're talking about benefit of the doubt of the sovereignty and providence of God, again, I just don't see how you can apply that with any consistency to say that, well, because somebody's going to be used for a medical experiment, therefore God doesn't give them a spirit. I mean, many Jews were used in medical experiments. Many children were used medical experiments in Nazi Germany. Does that mean that God didn't put a spirit in those people?
Yeah, Randy, I have to say, and then I guess I find it a little offensive that you're taking healthy people who are walking the planet and doing medical experiments on people who think, who have brainwaves, who live, who love, who have family members, and you're comparing it to an embryo that could just as well be miscarried and no one would notice. You're making them equivalent, and I must say I'm troubled by that.
Well, I can understand that you're troubled, and a lot of people are, Mark, but it comes back to why are we troubled? We're troubled because I'm believing that human value comes in the nature of it, who a human being is. And you're believing, apparently, and certainly many people do, that it's based upon function and capacity and ability, maturity, these things that are add-ons that don't relate to the essence of nature. I mean, surely we would all agree that all of us were this non-conscious, call it non-sentient, non-thinking, non-speaking human being early in the point of pregnancy at one time.
Sure, but all of us were egg and sperm as well,
right? No, we weren't. I mean, egg and sperm are two things that are not human beings. When they're first joined together, when that happens and conception takes place, that's when a human being with the DNA, the chromosomes, all of that, the
okay.
human
we were half egg and half sperm, if you will.
We were people who were the product of the merging of egg and sperm, but we were not egg or sperm.
Okay. I want you to hang on for me, Randy. We're going to go right back to Ann O'Hanlon after a very, very brief commercial break. Bert, thank you very much for your call. Ann O'Hanlon, well, first of all, what are your comments on what Randy Alcorn and I were discussing?
I had a few reactions this time to some of the things Randy said. One thing I wanted to comment on, he was objecting to the characterization of his side of this as anti-choice, but he has routinely been using the term pro-abortion to refer to our side. And, you know, nobody's pro-abortion. We understand that it can be an agonizing, emotional thing. What we are is pro-keeping the government out of people's private lives. It's a decision that women and their doctors and their families need to make, and we don't need the government sitting at the kitchen table with us while we're having these deeply personal conversations. So that is what we are, not pro-abortion. The other thing that troubled me that he seems to really like to bring up is an analogy between us and Nazi Germany, which I find inappropriate and extraordinarily offensive. I mean, that's just propaganda language. You know, we can keep this conversation civilized and discuss things. We don't have to use that kind of smear tactic. We are loving, caring people who understand that there are difficult decisions in life to be made, and we all wrestle with how they should be made and whether or not the government should be part of them. And so I just would ask him to keep the Nazi references out because I just think that is unfair and also makes him sound ridiculous. What I would love, Mark, if you can get to, and you haven't yet, is this sort of the current state of this debate really is beyond what a lot of this discussion has been about this hour so far and really is to the level of birth control, that Randy's side is not joining with us to promote birth control education to our young people, to promote birth control access to folks. In fact, there have been pharmacies refusing to fill birth control prescriptions, sort of right-wing pharmacists who say they're offended by the morality of birth control. This has happened in Wisconsin, Illinois, Massachusetts, Texas. increasingly happening all over the country, and we're seeing state legislatures take up the issue with the right, saying that they find birth control to be immoral. I mean, if these are folks who really want abortion to be on the wane, they need to work together with us, step across the aisle, and work to make birth control more effective and more accessible to everyone.
And let me ask you about the question of adoption. A lot of people that are pro-life point out that, well, we have some 1.3 million abortions. I don't know if that statistic is correct. Let me just throw that out. Is that statistic correct? A year in the United States? Is that about right?
You know, I am not totally sure, but I think it's around a million.
Okay, so we have a million abortions, and we have some 50,000 families or so. This is what a person on my blog said. Again, I'm not confirming this is true. I'm just passing on what someone wrote, and that people can't get enough babies for adoption. And how do you address that argument?
I'm not up to speed on adoption numbers, rather. I do know there certainly are kids out there who still need foster homes, need loving homes to go to. I doubt there are enough newborn healthy babies to meet adoption needs or wants, but I think there are lots of kids out there who probably still need loving families, and it sort of takes us back to, I think, where you see the Randy side on this thing is that they like to talk about little healthy babies, but people don't talk about, well, what about a woman who gets the diagnosis, you know, at 16 or 17 weeks into her pregnancy that she's got a very deformed fetus, that this is a child who would live but would not live with complete mental capacity or with, you know, profound physical deformity. They don't like to talk about those scenarios, and that yet those are the scenarios that a lot of people face. And I think also as you talk about adoption, you've got to still come back to, okay, so are you going to force me, if my birth control fails, you're going to force me by government edict to carry that pregnancy to term so that somebody else can adopt the baby? You know, it's just ridiculous. It sort of sounds like a totalitarian society that we're going to force all these women to carry their pregnancies to term to fill somebody else's, you know, desire to have a baby.
Okay, but Anne, explain to me this, and I promised I would ask you tough questions as well as Randy. If it's wrong to abort, if it's okay to abort a deformed fetus, fetus that will live as a child but will grow up severely mentally retarded or brain damaged or otherwise, you know, lacking and handicapped in some way. But it's not okay, I think we'd all agree, it's not okay to take a living human being who's 2, 3, 5, 10 years old, who has Down syndrome or is severely deformed. Certainly we won't encourage euthanizing that human being. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is the fundamental essence of the, you know, entire debate, which is, when does the government have a right to intrude upon a pregnancy? And what the law of the land has been since 1973 is that the government has the right to have a hand in this question once that fetus reaches the age of viability. Roe v. Wade allows states to ban abortion after viability, and we don't quarrel with that. In fact, 41 states do just that with our support. So abortion is illegal in most places in the country once that fetus can live outside of his mother's body. And so that's the difference, Mark, and that's what the difference has always been in this debate. It's sort of what you believe about where the government has a role.
The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. There are lines open now if you want to call in. We will be going over on the Internet. I do want to ask you, Anne, about a number of people who've written on the blog have basically decried the use of abortion as birth control. They're very upset that there are people who are terminating unwanted pregnancy not because of something extreme like rape or a deformed baby, but simply because they just decide the child isn't wanted. I think many of us who are pro-choice understand when there's a 16-year-old girl, or understand when someone's been raped or there's a deformed baby, but we have much less sympathy for a 30-year-old married woman who is upper middle class, who can afford a child and just doesn't want one. How do you address that situation?
Well, I think there are some abortions that people find easier to understand, if you will. And as somebody who takes the position I take, maybe I know more people in these situations. I hear more stories than others. And they run, you know, across a full spectrum. And I think just because some people are troubled by one scenario over another, again, the question comes back to, is it then the government's role? Is it, and again, it always feels to me like Big Brother is watching you. If we're going to say, well, the government can say that a middle upper class woman, okay, once she's earning a certain number of dollars a year, must carry her pregnancy to term. But if it's a, you know, poor woman who already has three kids, then we're not going to make her. I mean, you simply can't make these decisions as a piece of government policy, Mark. You've got to allow people to grapple with them individually and personally. And the right likes to paint us as people who do this as birth control, and it's simply a fiction that they find convenient and easy for their argument. And it's not the case. It's not what people do for birth control. It's ludicrous that anyone would even think that because, frankly, the expense and, again, the emotional and physical experience you go through when you have an abortion is not something small. Some women have more than one, but people don't use it as birth control. And so they like to sort of throw that out there instead of talking about the reality of it. And, you know, again, I would take you back to the question of if people are this upset about abortion, why aren't they working with us to make women understand better what birth control options there are and how they can get them?
It's a good question, and I'd like, Anne O'Hanlon, if you have time to stay just a little bit over.
No, I don't,
you
Mark.
Don't.
I'm
I apologize.
Sorry. The hour was all I could give today.
Fair enough. Thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Thank
I really
you for
appreciate
having this
it.
Conversation.
I thank you very much. That ends the radio portion of the Inside Scoop. I will go on just a little bit over on the internet broadcast. Hang on for that. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop, or at least those of you listening on the internet Inside Scoop. I wanted to run just a little bit over because there were a few points that went on back and forth that didn't get quite finished. So if you are listening on the internet, you're welcome to call in 877-57-SCOOP. I do have Randy Alcorn on for just a little bit longer. Randy, welcome back to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks, Mark.
Let me ask, because I think Anne O'Hanlon raises a very strong point about birth control. What is your view on birth control? Should it be readily available to people, or should government restrict it?
Well, I have no problems with the availability of birth control. My wife and I used birth control, conception control, a term I prefer, but contraceptives, many, many people do. I would say most pro-life people do. There are forms of birth control that if it's determined that they actually prevent implantation or they cause an early abortion, then understandably people, including myself, will have moral problems with them. But the general idea of contraception, no problem. Another thing that we advocate, though, that those on the other side, and I wish Anne could respond to this, is the idea of abstinence. You know, to some people, abstinence is this dinosauric type of thing. How can we even talk to our young people about that? And so we get opposed on this. Those of us who advocate the option of abstinence, even being taught as a way of thinking and a way of living in public schools, and they say, oh, you're going to impose religion, you know, on us and all that. And
but Randy, just to be clear on your position, you advocate teaching both abstinence and birth control in schools, or am I wrong there?
Well, I would advocate abstinence even more. With birth control, I have no problem with saying here are these different aspects of birth control. One thing that I don't like is when they pass out birth control to a classroom, which has happened sometimes in our area, and they say, look at this, here's where you can get it, touch it, handle it, hand it to the person behind you, the guy hands it to the girl, and everybody's giggling and all this kind of stuff, where you end up trivializing something that I think is sacred. So, yeah, because I do believe that premarital sex is a bad idea. I don't just believe that it's wrong. I believe that it's stupid in the sense that it brings destructive consequences to kids. And so, therefore, I don't think birth control should be handled in any flippant sort of way. So we'd probably have some disagreement on that.
Okay, but you'd prefer premarital sex with birth control over premarital sex that ends up in an abortion.
Yes, I would. There's, you know, I prefer almost anything to an abortion, but that doesn't mean that I think that it's a good idea to pass out birth control to kids. I think what it does is it ends up encouraging them to do something they don't need to do, which is to have sex. I mean, this culture is so inundated with the television and the movies and all of this, our youth culture, that adults are producing these programs. I think it's very irresponsible to portray premarital sex without portraying it as something that is just rife with negative consequences in the lives of these kids.
Randy, let me ask you this. What do you think, obviously you think abortion should be illegal, what do you think should be the punishment for women that have abortions? Is it murder? And if so, should we treat women who have abortions as if they've committed first-degree murder?
Well, the problem with that question is, in a culture where it has always been known that this is immoral and wrong, that it's murder to deliberately take the life of a human being, then that kind of punishment might be appropriate. But unfortunately, we live in a culture which we have taught people that the child is really not a child. We have taught people that abortion is not taking the life of a child, even though most people, when it comes down to it, they acknowledge if they're carrying a baby they want, that they say they have a baby inside of them. But if they don't want the baby, then it's really not a baby. It's really not a human being. Therefore, there are complexities with this. And I have to confess, Mark, I don't know the best way to answer this. I think we have to begin with not specific consequences for women or anybody involved in an abortion-related decision. I think we need to begin with a rethinking and then hopefully, ultimately, a reeducation of people in this area, because I really think that down the line, people will look back at this time in our culture, and they might even say to some of us, if we're still around as elderly grandparents, and you know, of course, in some cases we may not be around because of what we've taught them, that we're not as valuable and we don't contribute anymore, so we might be taken out of the way. But for those of us who are still around, they might say to us, now, wait a minute, you lived in that time where they just killed these unborn babies, and what did you do about it?
Yeah,
why did you think that way?
Well, I mean, the question is, I guess, what would you do about it? I mean, as someone, I used to work as an attorney in Congress, and laws are black and white. I mean, even if the question of when life begins is somewhat ambiguous, laws are there, and they punish, and they say, you go to jail for 5 to 10 years, you get the death penalty. If you were drafting the law in whatever state, in Oregon, I think it's where you live.
Yes.
If Roe v. Wade were overturned, which I know is something you support, and you were a state legislator in Oregon drafting the law, the crime of abortion, what would you propose as the punishment for a woman that has an abortion?
I honestly don't know the answer to the question, Mark, but I would suggest that perhaps there would need to be some graduated awareness over a period of time.
So
in
start
which,
with a fine, and then it moves on to prison terms, eventually it would be treated the same as first-degree murder?
Morally, ethically, I think I would argue on that basis, but only if, because that what we're talking about there is you know, premeditated murder. Premeditation acknowledges that the person knows that this is a human being that they're killing. So it's not premeditated murder, and therefore should
second
not
degree
be
murder
treated as premeditated. Well, first-degree murder if there is not a knowledge that this is a human being. One thing I would like to insert, though, that Ann said that did mischaracterize my position was when I mentioned the Nazis. I specifically mentioned, I did not say pro-choice people are Nazis. I didn't come close to saying that. I specifically said when she brought up that this is between women and their doctors and government shouldn't interfere, then I said, well, doctors are not always the best moral guides. Look at the doctors in Nazi Germany. Then when the gentleman called and said the thing about medical research, this is medical research, then I said, yes, but there was medical research done in Nazi Germany that we recognized was wrong.
I
just clarifies that's not the same as calling Anne or anyone else a Nazi. I was not doing that. I was making an analogy by virtue of the very things that she and the other pro-choice person were bringing up.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that, I do think it's excessive to compare abortion doctors to the Nazi doctors, but we'll just leave it there. Randy, thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop and giving us your time and your opinion. And folks, if you didn't get a chance to comment or you're listening on the archive, feel free to continue the debate. Just go to the weblog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Post what you want. Randy Alcorn, thank you very much for appearing on the Inside Scoop.
You're welcome, Mark. And one last question I throw out is, why don't people want to be called a pro-abortion? Because Ann said, don't call me pro-abortion. I would leave that aside with listeners. What's wrong with abortion that people would not want to be called pro-abortion?
Well, I think it's the same with any choice people have. I can very much understand someone who's personally very opposed to abortion but doesn't think it should be made illegal. So I guess that's how I would respond.
But if you were opposed to rape and kidnapping, you wouldn't be opposed to be calling anti-rape and anti-kidnapping.
Well, let me give you an example. Just in my own life, I happen to believe, and you may well disagree with me, and that's fair, I happen to believe in the legalization of marijuana, but I've never used marijuana. So I am anti-marijuana personally. I'm anti-drugs personally, but yet I wouldn't want to be called pro-marijuana, because I'm not pro-marijuana. I actually think it's a disgusting habit, but I also think smoking and alcohol are disgusting habits. I'm not pro-smoking, I'm not pro-alcohol, but I don't want to ban those either.
And yet we would all draw the line at some point and say if I said, well, I'm not pro-rape, I'm pro-choice about rape, you would look at me and you'd say, well, wait a minute, to be pro-choice about rape effectively is to be pro-rape, or to be pro-choice about kidnapping is effectively, or child abuse is to be effectively pro-child abuse. So I think if somebody says, well, don't call me pro-abortion, I'm just pro-choice against abortion, I guess my question would be, so what difference does that make? You're defending a procedure that I believe, scientifically is demonstrable is the taking of a human life.
Well, Randy, I'm going to put you on the spot there and turn the question around. Are you pro-tobacco smoking?
Personally, in my own life, no. I'm pro people having the right to smoke.
So would you have any problem with anyone calling you pro-tobacco?
If that's all they said and they didn't explain what they meant, then I would have.
Okay.
If they then explain.
All right. Fair enough. I just wanted to turn it around because
sure.
I think it's the same situation with the people who are pro-choice. I'm not pro-tobacco, but I think smoking should be legal. I think you're in the same situation that I am. You know, it's very interesting when these terms get thrown around. You know, if you're pro-life, the opposite is pro-death, which is awful. If you're pro-choice, the opposite is anti-choice, which is awful. I guess one of the reasons I think pro-life and pro-choice are just fine is because I guess I think that both sides should be able to define their own language,
Well, but one big problem with it, though, Mark, at least in my mind, is that when you're talking about pro-choice, choice means nothing. I mean, there's all kinds of choices. So which choice? So if somebody says, are you pro-choice, we shouldn't be able to even answer that question. The problem is, without saying what choice are you talking about. If you're talking about the choice of whether we go to a Mexican restaurant, a Chinese restaurant, whether we drive a certain kind of car, whether we live in a certain area, of course, we're all pro-choice
things.
Randy,
pro-life.
But choice has become a synonym for abortion. It's become a euphemism for abortion.
And so has life, all right? I mean, pro-life could mean I support that people should be living and shouldn't be murdered. Pro-life has also become a synonym for abortion. I just think these claims you're making against Anne are true, but the same could be made against your side because obviously everyone's pro-life, but pro-life and pro-choice I think are understood today to mean abortion.
But when you're talking about an abortion, though, it's a highly specific thing that this takes the life of a pre-born human being. So if that is pro-death or pro the right to for an adult to impose the death upon a child. So abortion is specifically death-related. So I think pro-life is not the same.
How about if we say this? Pro-legalization of abortion, anti-legalization of abortion.
That's very fair.
That's fair to both
you
sides.
Bet.
It's more accurate than either pro-life or pro-choice.
Yeah. It's probably not going to catch on, but
no,
it's good.
I don't think so. Thank you very much for coming on the show,
okay,
Randy.
Mark.